Sometimes I land under the moon.
Welcome to the Torah Teachers Roundtable, Apostolic Edition, with your hosts Rob Miller, Mark Patron, and yours truly, Mark Call. We hope you'll find this discussion entertaining, thought-provoking, and that above all, you'll be like the Bereans and search out the scriptures for yourself, see if these things be true. Good afternoon, folks. Welcome back once again. Happy Tuesday. And this is the Torah Teachers Roundtable Tanakh Edition. And this is one of the shows where we talk about some of the other parts of Scripture that don't get nearly as much press. It's also, I think, part of the reason that's true, because so much of this hits so close to home, especially for what yours truly has continually referred to as the whore church. Matter of fact, over the next few weeks, we're going to really see that come home as if it wasn't already pretty clear. But from here on out, it's going to get more and more obvious. In any case, what we have been talking about and towards the end of last week is Exodus chapter 20, and we're not quite through with the chapter yet. And the section that we've just kind of embarked in is often referred to, I like the term, the Greater Exodus. There was an Exodus about which was written in the book of Exodus, and indeed a lot of the Torah, having to do with Moshe and the mixed multitude that came out of Egypt. And the Bible says Exodus. And of course, right here, Ezekiel himself, we're going to see it again, and it'll be even a bigger Exodus and more all-encompassing than the first one was. So with that, let me introduce, we got both of our co-hosts, got Ken Irvin over here. Say hi to Ken, and then we'll go over to Mark Patron and let him weigh in too. How you doing?
I'm doing well, and howdy to all the listeners out there. Shalom to everyone.
Okay, very good.
Amen and amen.
So, Mark, I guess we'll say, how are you doing? Why don't you take us where you'd like to, and we'll pick it up.
I'm doing quite well, thank you, and everything is going well here, including with my 95-year-old father-in-law. He's an amazing old guy. Anyway, I'm looking at his Azamra on verses 34 and 35 of chapter 20. Where have we read? Can you read a little bit from 20 to 20, whatever?
Well, I read all the way through 45 last time, but let me start with the section having to do with the greater Exodus itself and some of the things leading
up
to it. So basically, he says in the later 20s.
Here. So you can...
I'll just go. Hang on, MP. Therefore, son of man, speak to the house of Israel. Say, thus says Yahuwah, in this your fathers have blasphemed me by being unfaithful to me. So he gives some details on that. Therefore, say to the house of Israel, thus says Yahuwah Eloheka, are you defiling yourselves in the manner of your fathers, committing harlotry according to their abominations? And then he goes on to say how that works with various types of idolatry. Shall I thus be inquired of by you, O house of Israel, as I live? No, I don't want you doing this, is basically what he says. He continues that theme, as I live, in verse 33, surely with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm and with fury poured out, I'll rule over you. I will bring you out from the peoples and gather you out of the countries where you have been scattered with a mighty hand, with an outstretched arm, and with fury poured out. So this sounds a bit like an exodus. I'll gather you again. Of course, we see other places where there's going to be a regathering. And I'll bring you into the wilderness of the peoples, and there will I plead my case with you face to face. Just as I pleaded my case with your fathers, Bamidbar, in the wilderness of the land of Mitzrayim, so will I plead my case with you, says Yahuwah Eloheka. I will make you pass under the rod, and I'll bring you into the bond of the covenant. I'll purge the rebels from among you, and those who transgress against me, I will bring them out of the country where they dwell, but they shall not enter the land of Israel. Then you shall know, and here it is again, Ki Ani Yahuwah. No, not that I am the Lord, that I am Yod Heh Vav Heh. And that was the whole point of the original Exodus. Sounds like it's going to be emphasized again. As for you, O house of Israel, thus says Yahuwah Eloheka, go every one of you serve his idols. And hereafter, if you will not obey me, but profane my holy name, no more with your gifts and your idols. So basically, you're going to do it. Oh, yeah. And elsewhere, he makes the point. You think they're going to save you? You holler out to them. Just see how well that works for you. For on my holy mountain, on the mountain height of Israel, says Yahuwah Eloheka, there all the house of Israel, all of them in the land shall serve me. There I will accept them, and there will I require your offerings and the first fruits of your zebach, your sacrifices, together with all of your holy things. Let's pause there at around verse 40. So go ahead, MP.
Okay, great. Okay, so Zamora has this on verse 34 and 35. It says, thus, verse 34 and following, depict the final redemption and ingathering of Israel at the end of days, which we have reached in our times. Okay, they think that we're in the end of days as well as we do. And I will bring you into the wickedness, a wilderness rather, of the nations in verse 35. Rashi states that this is the same wilderness in which the children of Israel journeyed for 40 years. Does this allude to the countries of the nations in which the Jews have lived during the long exile? Or could it be that the wilderness of the nations contains an allusion to the United Nations, where Israel is subject to daily remonstrations? Okay, that's what Azamra has. Yah promised, this here's me, that he will bring Israel home to her land, KJV says, out of the countries you are scattered to, with a mighty hand and a stretched out arm and with fury poured out. He is going to bring the exiles home to Haaretz Israel. Haaretz Israel. There will be some, perhaps, who are unaware of their Israelite background, having been assimilated for generations and perhaps centuries, forgetting their actual heritage over time. But Yah knows them and their heritage, and he shall follow through on this promise. Some of us Goyim might even be descended from the 12 tribes and not even know it. Stones Tanakh has this comment on verse 35. You will be punished in a deserted area so that your enemies do not witness your downfall. That's according to Radak, Rabbi David, I can't remember his last name. Anyway, the wilderness of the people, in the KJV, speaks of the desert and is from Hebrew 40:57, Midbar. Okay, Midbar. Basically, from the people to whom Yah is going to make his invitation home, to those who've been exiled for so long that they haven't a clue as to their lineage. Listen up, folks. This could be written specifically to you or me. This prophecy is over 2,600 years old. It is possible that we are all actually bloodline descendants of Yaakov. I think it is possible and may even be probable. How many Israelis actually came home from the Babylonian captivity? I have heard that less than half of the Babylonian diaspora went home. No way in our own power to actually know, but the possibility does exist that the entire earth's population can trace itself back to Israel and its diasporas. Okay? And Yah will let us know one way or the other when he chooses to. In Mashiach, direct bloodline ancestry is not essential. And all of the above speculation is a possibility. Okay, I speculated a whole lot there. But the probability is that a lot more of us are actually descended directly from Yaakov. We could show a direct line if we could make all the connections to him. Many of us could. Not necessarily me, not necessarily Mark Call, not necessarily Ken Urban, but a very good possibility that more than half of the people who are listening right now are a bloodline descendants of Yitzhak.
I'd go further than that.
That's
Mark. I think it's very likely.
34-35.
I would suggest it's very likely that a majority of people probably have at least some of that lineage, because there has been so much travel, so much intermixing,
absolutely,
and so much scattering. So I would find it very unlikely that a vast majority did not. Anyway,
yes.
Go ahead, Ken.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, the fact is that we're all everybody that's listening and everyone who's talking here today is looking for the truth in Yah's Torah, as well as in the prophets and the writings, and also in the Brit Hadashah. But we're looking for it in the Torah, and we're submitting ourselves to His Torah. And therefore, that gives you a really good idea that you probably are actually looking for your link back to Him. That's all I got.
Yep. That's the idea. So, let me address 33 to 36 myself here. Yah starts with mentioning of His mighty hand and stretched out arm and with fury poured out. And as we've seen a number of times here, just even in the past few chapters, that when such comes from Him, there is great change in the earth. And His changes are normally quite the opposite of what man is doing. And thus must the fury be poured out. And the reasoning for such great change is detailed in the following verses. He says that in this day, in the future, His children will be scattered throughout the world in many, if not all, countries. And He will draw them out from all those places, which reminds me of how He brought His people out of Mitzrayim, or Egypt, 1,000 years earlier than this point in time. Like MC had mentioned a little bit earlier, you know, this is likened to a second or a greater Exodus. He will draw them out from those places. And this future day could certainly be thousands of years later, which we know it is because of the fact that we are thousands of years later. And we know that that's really what He was speaking of then. And He brings them out from that bondage. And again, just like in the first Exodus in Mitzrayim, again, He brings His people into the wilderness and proclaims judgment upon them, or pleads with them. Which is in this translation here. I think the King James Version uses the word pleads, same word as judgment. And thus, if you question what such judgment would be like, just look back to our fathers' wanderings in the wilderness in the first Exodus to see how He will deal with us. It will be likened, and that's exactly what it says here in verse 36. It will be likened to it. And recall that the wilderness is a place, it is a dry place, where there is great thirst. And these seem to be the conditions that Yah likes us in for teaching and hearing and understanding purposes. We tend to focus on Him, and we tend to give Him more attention, and we tend to do what we have to do to make it through the circumstances when we're in such conditions. So I think He does this purposely, of course, but putting us through a wilderness period. Now that's up to 36. I do want to talk a little bit on 37 because this is all a part of that wilderness period. Okay, this time of testing is truly a time of testing, okay? It says that He will cause you to pass under the rod. And I think we really need to understand first this term, pass under the rod. Now, oddly enough, there is only one other instance that I can find of this phrase, pass under the rod, in all of Scripture. But I think we can make a good thematic connection to it to better understand its meaning. If you look at Vayikra or Leviticus 27, verse 32, it's written, "And concerning the tithe of the herd or of the flock, even of whatsoever passeth under the rod, the tenth shall be holy unto Yahuwah." Excuse me. We know the sheep are under subjection and authority of the shepherd, and thus pass under his rod, and one of ten is marked to be reserved unto Yah. You know, I even read about some folks who believe that back in the day, you know, this is thousands of years earlier, that they would actually, you know, the shepherds would herd all the sheep into a very narrow opening to where one goes through at a time. Only one can fit. And this way they can easily be counted as they go through. And every tenth one, the rod would have like something on the end of it, like a coloring, maybe paint type stuff.
Hey guys.
And they would literally mark sheep.
Anybody that's ever had anything to do with sheep or goats knows, or cattle for that matter, and I haven't done cattle, but I've certainly done the goats. There are a lot of times when you want to get them to go one at a time, because a lot of times they want to go all at once, and it definitely is easier the other way. So I can say, even if you're not wanting to count, there's a lot of reasons for doing that.
Right. So it does make a lot of sense. And two, it's funny. I remember going to, Ireland not long ago, and it seemed like every different farmer had a different coloring, because you saw like all of his sheep had marks on them that were in blue, and you go to some other sheep, you know, sheep fold down the road, and theirs is red or whatever, you know. Each neighbor had a different color, so it's kind of cool.
And they get together on that to make sure that nobody copies the other.
Yeah, right. So especially. Case one gets lost. Yeah. Yeah. You know which, you know, group that the sheep belongs to, you know?
Yep.
And we must recall that he, Yah, likens us to sheep. And Messiah himself likened himself to our shepherd and told all who were listening that all of his sheep know his voice and respond. And he was specific when he said unto those that asked, which happened to be his disciples, this is in Matthew 15, verse 24, he says, but he answered and said, I am not sent but unto the lost sheep of the house of Israel. And also he directed his disciples as they were being sent off into the world to share the good news in Matthew 10, verse 5 and 6, where it's written, these 12, Yahushua, or Messiah, sent forth and commanded them, saying, go not into the way of the Gentiles, and into any city of the Samaritans enter ye not, but go rather to the lost sheep of the house of Israel.
Amen.
I know that he will accomplish this via my heart, for example, to help me walk straight from within, and thus to become a spiritual being as he is. And he loves us enough to chastise us to make sure we get it right. You may recall, I just wanted to share just a few verses about chastisement, because this is important in terms of being tested and put through the wilderness period. This is Proverbs 3, verse 11, where it's written, my son, despise not the chastening of Yahuwah, neither be weary of his correction. Job 5, verse 17, it's written, behold, happy is the man whom Elohim correcteth. Therefore, despise not thou the chastening of the Almighty. And Proverbs 9, verse 8, it's written, reprove not a scorner, lest he hate thee. Rebuke a wise man, and he will love thee. I like that one. That's kind of cool. You often don't think about that in that way, especially with a scorner, because they don't know any better. In other words, expect chastising or chastening. He gives it to prove us and to make us worthy. It is his direction. And thus, being reproofed, we are made righteous in his eyes, and therefore we are under the bond of his covenant, as it's written here in this verse. Being in his covenant means that we are truly his, and thus considered his children, or Yisrael. Also, I think we might be surprised at the other English words that are rendered for the Hebrew word shebet, which is Strong's number H7626, which is translated as rod, in this verse that we're looking at here, verse 37. This word is also translated as scepter in this following verse. So this will give a little yet a little more of the inkling of authority. This is Bereshit or Genesis 49 verse 10, where that same word is scepter, and it's written, "The scepter shall not depart from Yehuda or Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet until Shiloh come, and unto him shall the gathering of the people be." But more often than not, and this is 141 of the 190 occurrences in the entire Tanakh, this word is translated as tribe or tribes. Even in the same chapter, as shown as the scepter, which is in Bereshit 49 again, just six verses later, we have it translated as tribe in Bereshit or Genesis 49 verse 16, where it's written, "Dan shall judge his people as one of the tribes of Israel." But the word tribe also gives us an understanding of Yah's selection. Okay, he only uses this word when addressing his children Israel, and thus tribes are a subset of his people. In other words, they are chosen and they are under his authority. So we should see all of the thematic connections of the different translational words in English that thematically connect to this word rod. Okay, so I just wanted to make a point in that so that those who are listening, those who are reading, you know, really understand what's being written here. I think that's really important. And I'm going to stop there at verse 37 and let maybe MP catch up a little bit and go beyond.
Yeah.
Go right ahead, MP.
All right. I'm going to comment on verses 36 to 39. I'm going to start with the Zamra. They say on verse 36 that it teaches that the final redemption will be an event quite as great and cataclysmic as the redemption from Egypt. God will bring the people back under the discipline of the covenant in verse 37 and purge out the rebels in verse 38. Now, in verse 37, Yah uses the phrase, "pass under the rod," which is not a modern phrase, so it's not readily available to us. But it was used in the wilderness adventure in Leviticus 27 and verse 32 and in Ezekiel's dad's book, you know, Jeremiah 33:13. I think it's about choosing the best for offering or separating those for sale and those to keep to strengthen the herd. That is the related passage in the Gospel of Matthew 25, the parable of the talents, where it is written in verses 14 through, my goodness, this is a long passage, through 30. "For as the man traveling into a far country called his own servants and delivered unto them his goods, and unto one he gave 5 talents, and to another 2, and to another 1, to every man according to his several ability, and straightway took his journey. Then he that had received the 5 talents went and traded with the same and made other 5 talents. And likewise he that had 2, he also gained other 2. But he that had received 1 went and digged in the earth and hid his master's money. After a long time, the master of those servants cometh and reckoneth with them. And so he that had received 5 talents came and brought other 5 talents, saying, 'Master, thou deliveredst unto me 5. Behold, I have gained thee 5 talents more.' His master said unto him, 'Well done, good and faithful servant. Thou hast been faithful over a few things, I will make thee ruler over many things. Enter thou into the joy of thy master.' He also that had received 2 talents came and said, 'Master, thou deliverest unto me 2 talents.
All right. Hey, I think we know the end, but we'll come back and pick it up right after the bottom.
And I pray, don't take me soon, as I am here for a reason. Sometimes in my tears I drown, but I never let it get me down. So when negativity surrounds, I know something. It all turns around with all my life. I've been waiting for, I've been praying for the people to say that we don't know what to fight no more. There'll be no more.
Okay, we are back. And MP, you were right in the middle of telling a parable that I suspect everybody knows how it ends, but let's go ahead and finish it up.
Yes, I will. I'll start at the beginning of verse 22, which is where I was cut off. He also that had received 2 talents came and said, Master, thou deliverest unto me 2 talents. Behold, I have gained 2 other talents beside them. His master said unto him, Well done, good and faithful servant. Thou hast been faithful in a few things. I will make thee ruler over many things. Enter thou into the joy of thy master. Then in verse 24, Then he which had received the 1 talent came and said, Master, I knew thee that thou art an hard man, reaping where thou hast not sown and gathering where thou hast not strawed. And I was afraid, and I went and hid thy talent in the earth. Lo, thou hast thine. And he hands him the 1 talent back. That was a Mark edit. Verse 26, His master answered and said unto him, Wicked and slothful servant, thou knewest that I reap where I sowed not, and gather where I have not strawed. Thou oughtest therefore to have put my money to the exchangers, and at my coming I would have received mine with usury, that is, interest. Take therefore the talent from him, he says to other servants, and give it to the man with the 10 talents. For unto every one that hath shall be given, and he that shall have, he shall have abundance. But from him that hath not shall be taken away even that which he hath. And cast ye the unprofitable servant into outer darkness, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Outer darkness is outside of anything that has light. In other words, outside of Yah's creation. He's going to be destroyed and sent away. So the servants had profited their master, while the camp follower just returned what had been delivered to him to prove his worth. The term outer darkness is used 3 times in the KJV, all in Matityahu's gospel. The word translated darkness is skia. I forget what the name of the Greek letters are, so I'm not going to deal with that. But it says, properly, a shadow. Shade caused by the interception of light. Okay, blocked from the light. It isn't that they didn't have access to the light, but they had a barrier set up between themselves and the light, and that probably by themselves. They probably put it up themselves. That's too bright. I can't handle it, you know. Put it away. Yah provided all the light they needed, and they eschewed the Yah-given access. Yah says that his recall of Israel from the 4 corners of the earth will be just like it was from Egypt, which is a great template to use. Remember that Israel did not go down to Egypt as captives, but as visitors with their long-lost brother Yosef. It was only after Yosef's death that they were made servants and slaves, and Yah was going to do exactly as he did then, take them out of bondage that he had sent them into, just as he did in Yosef's day, and will eventually bring them back in from the cold, as he did in Moshe's day. The point of the talents is the same. You do what will further Yah's kingdom, and you will receive rewards commensurate to your effort. And that's what I got through verse 39.
Go ahead, Ken.
Yeah, let me say a quick thing about that interesting parable there in Matthew 25, and that is that I really think the fellow who put away his talent, you know, hid it. I believe the man definitely must have feared what was out there in the world, for one thing. Okay, he had greater fear of man than he did Yah.
That's so, kind of like what the government and the news is doing to us, isn't it? Or trying,
right? Yep. Trying to influence us and who we fear. Yeah.
Yep.
So, I mean, I think this is one of the circumstances where if you do fear man and the world more than you do Yah, then you end up not doing the works of Yah, but, you know, giving in to the works of man. And that's, I think, exactly what happened with this fella. He decided not to do the works of Yah, which was to go out there and try to spread this or make this talent expand into more, you know, just like we do with his word and being fruitful. You know, we try to plant a seed that it may grow more fruit. And we try to get the fruit out there, you know. but, you know, this fellow wasn't about that. So it's kind of a shame that people are not sometimes willing to put forth the effort, which is it takes effort. It really does. Because you're literally battling against your own flesh. You know, your flesh is afraid, or it might fear something, and you're just going to give into it and, you know, do whatever it takes to keep your flesh happy, you know? And I think that's what happened to this fella. Anyway, so yeah, that was, that is a really good story for all of us. Now let me jump to commenting on verse, let's see, 38. I don't think I commented on 38 to start with, which 38 talks about purging out the rebels that transgressed against him. And they will not enter into the land of Yisrael. I believe the action from the previous verse is what purges out the rebels. He and he alone knows the heart, and thus he is able to judge. And judgment results in a purging of the rebels or wicked ones from amongst the midst of the righteous. And of course, if one is purged, one is unclean or unable to partake in the inheritance, which is regarding his land. So this particular verse seems to ring true in my head as I'm being shown who receives the inheritance. Remember, this is what's written in by Shaul in Romans 9 verse 4. Who are the Israelites to whom pertaineth the adoption and the glory and the covenants and the giving of the Torah and the service of Yah, by the way, such as talents, and the promises. Yeah, the promises that were given unto Abraham and his seed, Yitzhak and Jacob. It's only the seed of Abraham that receives the inheritance, which is the land. This means that one who lives by faith in him, who is to be called Yisrael. And that is exactly what Christianity strives to do today. You know, we learn about faith of just hearing and reading his word and believing it. You know, we're not seeing it, are we? We're not seeing him do any of these wondrous things like Yisrael coming out of Mitzrayim did. You know, they saw it, and yet they still fell short afterwards. That's amazing to me, but, you know, they really did. And here we believe in him solely by faith. And that means a lot to him. Let me comment a little further on verses, 39 through 42. Because here, but Yah is making it clear that the whole house of Yisrael will remain in the state that they are in which they made for themselves. but they will no longer pollute his name with gifts and idols. He goes on to tell about the true house of Yisrael, in whom are in the land and will serve him, and thus he will accept them. His ways will be their ways, thus presenting to him a sweet savor or smell unto his nostrils. See, these will be the lost sheep in the end of days, which are gathered from all the nations where they are scattered, and the heathen around them will see the righteous within them. They will be the remnant that he will bring forth from amongst the nations. And once this happens, we and those around us will know that he is Yahuwah. I mean, after all that he has written about this time, if we don't get it at that point to say, wow, this happened just as it was written. He is exactly who he says he is. Hallelujah. You know, then we don't understand anything. And that's all I could say, you know? And that's what he's trying to say here. It is his first fruits, which is a picture of that particular feast day, a matter of fact, the feast of first fruits. Now remember, not the first of the first fruits, which was the barley harvest. Okay, that was Messiah was the first of the first fruits, but we follow him later with the wheat harvest. Okay, so we are the wheat. We are the ones that will, as Messiah put it, we will be standing amongst the tares, right? The tares or the weeds, they will fall over. They'll end up being blown away and burnt away as ash and blown to all four corners of the earth. But we will stand. We will be able to stand as that wheat harvest, and we will stand before the Father just as Messiah did. Our day will come. Anyway, that's what I'm reading or seeing up through verse 42 here. All again about the future. And I'll go ahead and stop there and let MP catch up again.
All right. Now I've covered through verse 39 so far, right? Point of the talents is the same. Yeah. Okay.
I believe so.
Okay. So I'll cover verses 40 to 44. Here's a Zamra on that. First of all, the mountains in the height of Israel is Mount Moriah, and I'm giving you a heads up for it. The mountain in the height of Israel is Mount Moriah, the Temple Mount, where all the priests had apostatized and worshiped the sun as it rose in the east. TSK has this to tell us about that. They say these predictions, okay, TSK is talking about in verse 40, received a partial accomplishment by the restoration of the Jews from the Babylonian captivity, but they seem chiefly to relate to the establishment of the Christian church, and more especially to the future conversion of the Jews and their restoration to their land. Now, verse 40 promises the restoration of the temple services on the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. And I shall be sanctified through you in the eyes of the nations. Okay, there's the TSK is a Christian kind of publication, okay, Treasury of Scripture Knowledge. And it generally, it gives you some pretty good stuff, but it likes to denigrate the Jews, okay? There's nothing to denigrate about the Jews, okay? The official Judaism did not accept Yeshua, but that doesn't mean that Judaism didn't accept Yeshua, okay? The officials didn't, because he would have taken away their power, okay? They couldn't have that. So anyway, that's an aside by me. But TSK has this to say on verse 40. These predictions received a partial accomplishment by the restoration of the Jews from the Babylonian captivity, but they seem chiefly to relate to the establishment. Oh, I'm sorry, I read that one already. I personally disagree that it points to the church, but Esord is definitely predisposed to anything good coming in Israel Yehuda as meant for the Christian church. The church doesn't like the fact that Yeshua is setting up the eternal messianic kingdom in Jerusalem as it is portrayed in Revelation chapter 21 and 22, and as he intended for Israel to set up in the land about 4,000 years ago. Anyway, Zamra has this to say on verse 41. It's very brief. Through you, I will be sanctified in the eyes of the nations when they will see that my hand has ruled. That's according to Metzudas David. Now, verse 41 obviously speaks of Yah bringing Israel, Yehuda, from the four corners of the earth into which they had been scattered in the end of days. As we saw in Revelation 22 on TTRT, lo, those few years ago with Rob Miller as our sidekick. And do you see how Yah finishes verse 41? In verse 41, he stops with, I will accept you from the people and gather you from the countries to which I had scattered you, and I will be sanctified before the heathen. That's the gathering of holy Israel, the spiritual children of Abraham, from the four corners of the earth. That is end of days talk and includes all believers of all time. I'm going to quit there at verse 41. I'll let you come back to us, Ken.
Sure. And yeah, what we're reading about here regarding in the eyes of the heathen, I think that's so important in that, you know, that word heathen is also translated as Gentiles, or goy, you know, goyim, right. Plural. Yeah. And, you know, that is, like MP was saying, is all peoples from anywhere. I mean, and that's what we saw happen in Mitzrayim or Egypt as well. Remember, a lot of those Egyptians who had spent their whole lives worshiping all these other gods from Egypt. Boy, they were amazed when they saw this other Elohim come along and just wipe out all their gods, you know, wiped them all out, made fun of them, burnt them up, whatever, you know, all those plagues came through, took care of them all, even whatever the Pharaoh might have, you know, thought he was. And they knew that he was the Elohim of all Elohim. So he was, you know, that was in their sight. And a lot of them went with Israel, people of Israel, when they left the land. And that's exactly what's going to happen again. That's why Yah wants them to see so that they will believe, you know. It's just hard for them to believe by faith when they're not studying it like a lot of us are. So, of course, this is one way of doing it. So, yeah, I think that's very important to him that all of this is done in their sight, you know. So, let's see. I commented to 42. Let me comment on 43 and 44 because this is kind of a short blurb from him, from Yah, but you can see that, that he's just making it plainly clear that they're wicked, they're defiled, they're loathsome, you know, but even those that he chooses as his remnant, even these people, okay, they will remember their wicked ways and they will loathe themselves in remembering their sins. And we know what that's like, don't we? I think we all do. Because once we come to him, this is exactly how we feel, isn't it? You know, we are sickened by our own ways that we remember as being. And half the time we think, wow, I can't believe I was like that. Or I can't believe I did that. You know, you think back and you think, gosh, I was such a sinful person. And you really do feel that feeling of, you know, loathing yourself. And this is what makes them know that he is Yahuwah, who is able to straighten them out. Even though they were defiled, and their ways were wicked and corrupt, because we know what that's like, don't we? That's exactly how we were in our flesh. And then we came to know him, and then we came to choose rightly and think, wow, I really do need to change myself. I need to become a spiritual being, you know?
Amen.
Yeah, amen. And he's able to do that from within us, you know? That's what he does through his spirit. His spirit changes us, and we are to literally work on our own spirit, aren't we? We're to circumcise within, you know? And that's what we end up doing once we choose him. We work really hard at it. I think we all do, at least the three of us in this room. In many ways, I'm kind of proud of all three of us in where we're at and, you know, how we understand things. It does take, a lot of choosing rightly and, you know, putting on the right pairs of glasses to really take all of this word from beginning to end and to make it fit together, which, at least from what I see today in many denominations, they don't do. You know, many, especially many Christian denominations, you know that they believe that, you know, stuff in the Brit Hadashah or New Testament has just done away with stuff that's in the old, and that there's all this big change, you know.
That's one of the things that amazes me.
Okay. Me too.
It's one of the things that really amazes me about the church. They don't understand that if you start reading at Genesis 1:1 and you read completely through the Bible, you will find you go through the same story at least 10 or 15 times. It just keeps repeating itself and repeating itself and repeating itself to try to drive the point home to us stupid suckers out here. Okay?
Mm-hmm. That's true.
He's trying to drive the point home. And so he tells us over and over and over and over again. And the kingdom being set up in Israel is repeated by the kingdom being set up in the Olam Haba, the world to come. Okay? It just all repeats and repeats and repeats. Okay? And if you're open to it, if you're looking for it, you'll see it everywhere. I mean, it's amazing how he wants to drive the important points home, and he does it regularly. Okay, so.
I know, and we saw it when we went through the scroll of Yirmiyahu or Jeremiah, because he repeated things over and over again to those people. Yeah. And we're seeing it here again in Ezekiel. Yeah, over and over again. And that's just how stubborn and stiff-necked
we are. Why don't you get this? I've told you 15 times. You know,
right?
I can see him slapping them. You know.
Oh, so true. I know. Anyway, these two verses, 43 and 44, are Yah is truly addressing those that he is changing, you know, and we fit into that so well. If you think about it, we fit this perfectly in terms of how we started off in our flesh, and we have learned more about him and chose to walk in his ways and try to learn, you know, what he has to say and try to walk in it, you know, walk upright. It's not easy. But, you know, it is painful when it's against the flesh. You know, you feel the pricks.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But,
and that's what drives the point home.
Right. Yes. It needs to hurt. You know, chastisement does its job well, I think. And that's a sign that he loves us, you know, when it hurts.
Absolutely.
We should know that he's doing it for our own well-being and to help us become spiritual beings.
All right, and wait,
I'll stop.
And I pray, don't take me soon, cause I am here for reasons. Sometimes in my tears I drown, but I never let it get me down. So when negativity surrounds, I know someday.
Welcome to the Torah Teachers Roundtable, Apostolic Edition, with your hosts Rob Miller, Mark Patron, and yours truly, Mark Call. We hope you'll find this discussion entertaining, thought-provoking, and that above all, you'll be like the Bereans and search out the scriptures for yourself and see if these things be true.
All right, we
And there was so much distraction with the news at the top of the hour. You hear the news at the top of the hour and you realize, boy, they are really lying through their teeth to do everything possible to prevent the truth coming out. And essentially, that takes us back to the Torah portion, or the readings for today from the book of Ezekiel. Because that was the same thing they're seeing here too. Lots of prophets that were speaking falsely, and a whole lot of stuff that they didn't want to come out. And Yah's telling them, you know, it's going to be really bad. And if you think it's bad in chapter 20, just wait till we get into the next one. But anyway, who are we? I think it was MP, and I think go ahead, Mark.
Okay, I'm ready to move from verse 41 to 44, and here we go. Verse 41 obviously speaks of Yah bringing Israel and Yehuda from the four corners of the earth into which they had been scattered in the end of days, as we saw in Revelation 22 on TTRT, lo, those many years ago, with Rob Miller as our sidekick. And do you see how Yah finishes verse 41? He says, I will accept you from the people and gather you from the countries to which I have scattered you, and I will be sanctified before the heathen. That's the gathering of holy Israel, the spiritual children of Abraham, from the four corners of the earth. That is end of days talk and includes all believers of all time. Yah is saying in verses 42 and 43 that we will remember all that we had done to deserve the exile that we were in, because of how we took for granted that what our fathers had done to secure Haaretz and thought that it was actually ours by right, and that we had nothing to do with keeping it as holy as it was on the day that we got it. We ought to apply that thinking to our ways now, because the end of days is in sight. Even if you're myopic, the end of days is in sight. In verse 33, has Yah telling the faithful in Yerushalayim and in Babel that we would remember all that we'd done to make ourselves detestable, even to ourselves, for all that we had done to defile ourselves and our land. Are you getting it yet? We, all these centuries after the fact in evidence, are every bit as guilty as our Avot were. We need to take our fathers' actions on ourselves, because we are not even close to as set apart to Yah as they were. Here's a Zamra on this portion. They say, this will be the war of Gog Umagog, according to Radak. At the end of days, Israel will look back over their history and understand the root cause of the suffering that they endured in exile, their own rebellions. In verse 43, and this new level of self-understanding will keep them bound to the service of El forever after. Now, verse 44, Yah tells us that we will actually come to understand that He has wrought in us, with us rather, even in our sins, for His ultimate blessings to come to us despite our wicked corruptions. This is addressed to whole B'nai Yisrael, the whole house, not just those who are reading or listening, but all of us who deserve no blessing from Him. And the only reason He bestows the blessing is because He chooses to love us. His loving kindness is ours for the taking if we will just obey Him. That's what I got through verse 44.
How about you, Ken?
Okay, well, I'll go ahead and finish up with verses 45 to 49 then, through the end of the chapter here. And I kind of see all that as one section speaking of the South. So scripturally speaking, the South is usually referred to when speaking of in Yehuda or even down into Mitzrayim. But since Yah is addressing all of Yisrael in these verses, I'd have to gather that He wants Ezekiel to prophesy towards all south of Yerushalayim, which, again, would be Yehuda. That's who's there in this day, a matter of fact. And as we have seen, that He often relates trees to people when He speaks in parables, these verses are no different. I believe that he is speaking to all of those in the land, specifically those in the south or in Yehuda, and those whom are still green or dry will burn and wither away to ash. I believe this is chastening that may result in death for those who are in too deep or entrenched in their own ways. And many fires will result in death when it, you know, when he talks about the fire that burns within. And thus he states that his fire will not be quenched. I believe when he says that that fire will not be quenched, it's kind of a figurative of leading to death, meaning that there, you know, everything will be consumed. That's his desire. All will be consumed and the land will be cleansed and it can rest. And this is usually what he does. When the land is full of wickedness, it's actually saying that from the south all the way to the north shall be burnt therein. So that's really covering the whole area, you know, from the south all the way to the north. And it says all the flesh shall see and, that the fire is being kindled by Yah. And that it will not be quenched. And of course, then you have the people saying, oh, or well, actually not the people, but, it says, then said I, so this is Ezekiel speaking in the last verse. He's very surprised. Elohim, Yahuwah, they say of me, doth he not speak parables? Yes. Well, they have to learn that he's always spoken in parables, and you need to start understanding these things that he's talking about. You can't just take it as, you know, plain verbiage, you know. Every green tree, oh, okay, is there a certain kind of trees I'm looking for? Yeah, you know, you need to understand what things are. So that's what parables are all about. He likens things to other things, and we have to understand such in order to understand what he's getting at. Now, otherwise, you're just
tree,
lost it.
That's really interesting.
Right.
every green tree is talking about every living thing, basically.
Okay? Yeah, really.
Because it's
got leaves.
Everybody that's breathing air. So.
Right. or and every dry tree. So here you have both conditions, really.
There you go.
You have all the trees, yeah. Anyway, so that's kind of how he ends the chapter here, covering everyone yet again, only looking at it differently. Which, you know, the more you see the way he addresses things in different ways, you then understand what his parables are really about. You know, such as trees, you know, he likens us to trees, or sometimes he likens us to sheep. And we saw that earlier too. So, you know, yeah. So that's, again, that's to help us learn. The more he does such things, the more he, expounds in different ways, like he is even in just this one chapter. He's, his parables jump from one, situational thing to another, and that helps us to understand them and thematically connect them. So anyway, that's what I have to the end of the chapter. I'll go ahead and let you finish up there, MP.
All right. This shouldn't take but about 3 or 4 minutes. Verses 45 to 49. This chapter closes with a prophecy for Jerusalem. The south is Eretz Israel because the route from Babel is about due west for 300 miles and then south about 150 miles, generally west from Babel to the promised land, but then 150 miles south to get to Israel, okay? Generally west, but south as well. The forest to the south of Babel is Israel and points west like Egypt. The desert is all that's south of Babel until you get to the Indian Ocean and maybe Antarctica. No one wants to live in Antarctica. Even the United States Navy is only there for 6 months per summer, and that's Antarctica summer, which isn't really summer. Anyway, good luck getting an army there 2,600 years ago anyway. So why to the south? Because even though you had to move west first, you also had to move south from about Damascus, once you crossed the Ardennes River, which was the only natural barrier between Babel and Yerushalayim. There were no minor creeks, I'm sure, a few minor creeks, I'm sure, but the only major rivers to cross would be the Euphrates, and that would be soon after leaving Babel. So TSK says that the forest of the south is Yerushalayim, as full of inhabitants as the forest is of trees. And once west of the Ardennes, there is little to stop them. Yah is going to kindle a fire in Yerushalayim. And verse 47 reads a little like the war at the end of Revelation 20, when the unbelievers of the earth under Hasatan's influence came up against Yerushalayim and its king Mashiach to try to overthrow his kingdom. TSK has this comment on Yeshua's, I will kindle. Okay? Yahweh, I will send war, and it shall destroy all ranks and characters of the people. And that absolutely corresponds, to my mind anyway, to Revelation 20 and that lake of fire. And when the 1,000 years are expired, Satan will be loosed out of his prison and shall go out and deceive the nations which are in the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them together to battle, the number of whom is as the sand of the sea. And they went up on the breadth of the earth and compassed the camp of the saints about and the beloved city, and fire came down out of heaven and devoured them. Okay? Not the saints and the beloved city, but them that were surrounding it. And the devil that deceived them was cast into the lake of fire and brimstone, where the beast and the false prophet are, and shall be tormented day and night forever and ever. I think we're looking at prophecies that are given about 700 years apart that speak to the same events, but with different actual recipients of the destruction. If we have been seen all throughout Yah's word, he repeats himself over and over again. We talked about that a little bit ago. And we are either too wicked or just too stupid to comprehend it. The lake of fire, by the way, is not quenched. It just devours all the matter that there is to devour. No one puts it out. It goes out because it's burned everything. And then Yah creates a creation that will know only righteousness. Zeke's audience just can't comprehend, largely because they don't have the resources we have, which is actually in their favor because they didn't have our information and revelation. If they had, like our world today, they still would not believe and shuv to Yah. Like the vast majority of our world today, eternal death is on the horizon for this world, and the world will not see it, being purposely ignorant of what's coming. Keep your accounts short with Yah, folks. Ignorance is not an excuse. That's what I got for this book, or for this chapter.
All right. And by the way,
are we ready, Ken?
Did you even read through the end of the chapter? I wasn't sure.
We were talking before the show. I said the reason I read ahead is it's like this. So there we go. No, I didn't.
Okay. Well,
Anyway, so let me just read the last couple of verses because we've already talked about them. MP's already read them, but he read them from the King James, and sometimes that's a little bit harder to understand. He is making the point here. Then you shall know Ki Ani Yahuwah, when I've dealt with you for my name's sake, not according to your wicked ways, nor according to your corrupt doings, O house of Israel, says Yahuwah Eloheka. Furthermore, the word of Yahuwah came to me saying, son of man, set your face toward the south. MP talked about the south. Preach against the south. Prophesy against the forest land, the south, and say to the forest of the south, hear the word of Yahuwah. Thus says Yehuelah, hey, behold, I'll kindle a fire in you, and it'll devour every green tree and every dry tree in you. The blazing flame shall not be quenched, and all faces from the south to the north shall be scorched by it. All flesh shall see that I, Yahuwah, have kindled it. It shall not be quenched. And then I said, O Yahuwah Eloheka, they say of me, does he not speak parables? So I guess you could say, yeah, he has been, and there we go. And we're ready for the next chapter, if you are, Ken. But you want to add anything before we do?
No, I'm good with moving on to the next chapter. Go ahead, and if you would, read a few verses there.
Okay.
At least verse 5, if you would.
Chapter 21. It's chapter 21 is going to make a real consistent point having to do with the sword. And it's going to say this quite a bit. So we'll talk about that. And the word of Yahuwah came to me saying, son of man, set your face towards Jerusalem, preach against the holy places, and prophesy against the land of Israel. And say to the land of Israel, thus says Yahuwah, behold, I'm against you, and I will draw my sword out of its sheath and cut off, and listen to this, he's going to repeat it so we make sure it's clear, cut off both righteous and wicked from you. Because I will cut off both righteous and wicked from you, therefore my sword shall go out of its sheath against all flesh from south to north. Then all flesh may know that I, Yahuwah, have drawn my sword out of its sheath. It shall not return any more. And let me read one more verse, and we'll go to you, Ken. Sigh, huh? Sigh, therefore, son of man, with a breaking heart, and sigh with bitterness before their eyes. All right, go ahead.
Yeah, verses 1 through 5 are about the cutting off of mankind from the land, and this includes the righteous and the wicked. So this may very well be the completion or for fulfillment of his word back in Ezekiel 7, verse 2, where he said, also thou son of man, thus saith Elohim Yahuwah unto the land of Israel, an end, the end is come upon the four corners of the land. And note also the order in which Yah addresses everyone in these five verses. He starts with Yerushalayim and the holy places. Yep. We should remember that when it comes to judgment, he always brings judgment to his own house first before he addresses anyone else. And apparently this is no exception. He points out that he will use the sword on all flesh. So this appears to address death and not capture or captivity when the sword is in the sole form of judgment mentioned here. And to say that the sword shall not return to its sheath anymore is kind of likened to the end of last chapter in which his fire within them would not be quenched. You know, it does not appear that any flesh will skirt or escape from his grasp in this judgment. And I think he's just making it really clear here in verses 1 through 5. Now, verse 6, since you went ahead and read that too, let me go ahead and comment on verse 6. First, I have to say that I find it surprising that I only find this form of the word sigh, anak, in the Hebrew, Strong's number H584, only 11 times in the entire Tanakh, this word sigh. I'm really surprised. Now, I know there's a lot of other words you would expect, such as mourn. You know, words like this, but you know, there is just so much going on in the entire Tanakh, especially after the Torah, when Yah is trying to bring them back to his word, you know, that you would expect to see the word sigh a lot, but no, only 11 times. And of those 11, four are found in Lamentations, which, yeah, that kind of makes sense. And three are found here in the scroll of Ezekiel, So just between the two, between Lamentations and the Scroll of Ezekiel, you have 7 of the 11. I would have expected much more knowing the dilapidated spiritual condition that his people, Israel, found themselves in for literally thousands of years through history. And also the word bitterness in this verse is only found once in all of scripture, which is the word Meri Ruth in the Hebrew, Strong's number 4814. Now, it's probably not pronounced that way, even though Strong says it is, because, you know, even the word Ruth or the name Ruth in the Hebrew would have been pronounced root, you know, with a T at the end, not a T-H. So that word is probably more like Meri Ruth. But bitterness is usually translated from the Hebrew word mar or mara in the Hebrew, Strong's number 4751. Now, this is more commonly used Hebrew word. This one here, mar or mara, seems to be more of a root of the other anyway. And thus the word found in, here in Ezekiel 21 verse 6 is unique, but I don't have the resources here to find out its, you know, differentiation, I guess. I'm not sure if I got the right word there, and I do apologize. But I'm guessing that it is an agonizing bitterness, maybe as bitter gets, considering the feeling of the breaking of the loins. And Ezekiel is again told to put on this show before all of Israel to indicate possibly the greatest of sorrow mixed with pain, you know? And of course the breaking of the loins, that's a pretty harsh, thought right there. That's really down inside. That's, usually the heart, the soul, it kind of brings me to Psalm 51, you know, how we are to literally break down our own spirit so that we can grow in him, you know, put away our own flesh so that we can grow into a more spiritual being. It kind of brings me to that understanding or likening to it anyway. So anyway, that's what I have up to verse 6. I'll go ahead and stop there and give MP a turn.
Well, let me make one brief comment before we go to MP, and that is the other place, and we just talked about it not long ago, one of my favorites here in Ezekiel that we see the word sigh and cry, and the roots are actually pretty similar. It's a na and a knock, so there's a certain poetry to it in the Hebrew, but it's in Ezekiel chapter 9, where he says, this is the angel with the inkhorn, go through and find all the men that sigh and cry, a na and a knock, about all the abominations that are being done. And certainly that fits with what we're talking about here, too.
Amen.
Go ahead, Mark.
Amen. Okay. Well, I got about 20 seconds. So
2 seconds.
Let's use them.
No, really.
Three prophecies in chapter 21.
Oh, there you go.
And I pray, don't take me soon, cause I am here for a reason. Sometimes in my tears I drown, but I never let it get me down. So when negativity surrounds, I know someday the Lord turns around, because all my life I've been waiting for, I've been praying for the people to stay.
Do 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 dum do be do dum dum. Come a come a dum do be do dum dum. Come a come a dum do be do dum dum. Keep the doors up.
We are back, folks. Last segment for today for our teachers roundtable. And when we went to the bottom of the hour, I shorted MP. So let's go back to him and let him actually have time to say something.
Okay, that's good. There are three prophecies in verse 21. Okay, chapter 21, verses 2 through 7, verses 8 through 17, and verses 18 through 32. And the narrative actually begins in verse 2. Okay, I mean, think about it. What is the opening statement of chapter 22? Moreover, the word of Yah came unto me saying, okay? Okay, so three prophecies. Here we go. Azamra on verse 1 through 3 says this. Following the prophecy of the final redemption in the closing section of the previous chapter in Ezekiel 20 verses 20 through or 40 through 44, our present chapter contains very harsh prophecies about the imminent calamity that was looming over Jerusalem as Ezekiel spoke. The destruction of the first temple was only 4 years ahead. The first of these prophecies was once again heavily veiled in allegory. Son of man, set your face towards the south and preach towards the south the prophecy against the forest of the field of the south. Behold, I will kindle a fire in you, and it shall devour every green tree in you and every dry tree. That's verses 2 and 3. Yah uses primitive roots to make sure there will be no wiggle room. And the word KJV translates as set is the Hebrew 7760 seem, or possibly sum, okay, to set or to set, to place or to set down. I do not think there was any wiggle room on for Zeke's face. So Yah made it possible for him to place his complete attention on carrying out this command. The order is for Zeke to drop toward the holy places, which I assume was the Temple Mount. KJV adds an explanatory, italicized, thy word, which means the translators assume something not in evidence. The word translated drop is H5197, that's the Hebrew word, 5197, nataf, and it means to flow from within. So I picture this particular prophecy to flow from Zeke's mouth like a river's waterfall over a cliff. I picture Niagara Falls, including the volume of both the water and the noise. Yah was going to use Zeke to get something very different, off his chest. This prophecy is toward the land of Israel, not necessarily the people, although they will feel the heat as well. Verse 3, Zeke is to say to the land of Israel that Yah is going to cut off the land from its people, both the righteous, the tzaddikim, and the wicked, the rasha. In other words, he is telling the land in verse 4 that he is removing its so-called caretakers from it, and that he is going to remove them violently. The Chaldees have also had enough of Yehuda's Israel's rebellion, and Yah is going to use them to promote to remove the rebels to points all over the east and north. Some of the rebels will do as their predecessors had 30 or 40 years ago, before, when they carried Yirmiyahu with them in the first diaspora to the west, and then points north toward Europe and the British Isles. The Irish claim that Yirmiyahu brought Yah's word to them. Now, I think, and they've got a really, really old plaque up to show it. Anyway, I think that Jerry actually found his way back home through northern and eastern Europe, the Caucasus Mountains, and then south. Anyway, whatever the outcome, Yehuda Israel had made such asses of themselves to Yah and his faithful that Yah is warning the land itself that it will be on its own for a while until Israel comes out of its stupor and returns to him. When the large enough group, led in my opinion by Daniel and Shema, come to their senses, they will return to the land but never have complete control again until Shiloh comes. As it is today, if the UN and the U.S. had not fought for a Jewish homeland in the Abrahamic land grant, the nation would still be in total diaspora. As it is, even though there is a Jewish homeland, which just happens to be the land of Yah as well, Jews are the small minority in the region and would likely have been wiped out if the nomadic tribes could come together for more than a bitch session. There does have to be a good reason for Mashiach's return to the land that we see in Revelation 19:11 and following. That will be when the surrounding nations press Israel to its breaking point and she turns to Yah for deliverance. I think that Sleepy Joe and Sleep Around Canny may be the catalyst for this in the not very distant future. At least I can picture the possibility without any trouble at all. That's what I got through verse 4.
Okay, go ahead.
And the commentary on today.
Well, I commented up through verse 6, and I think we only read up through 6. So if you want me to
go on, then
I need you to read some more.
So sigh, therefore, is where we paused. Son of man with a breaking heart, sigh with bitterness before their eyes. And it'll be that when they say to you, why are you sighing? You shall answer, because of the news. When it comes, every heart will melt. All hands will be feeble. Every spirit will faint. And all knees will be weak as water. Behold, it's coming and shall be brought to pass, says Yahuwah Eloheka. And I'll read the one poetic section here, too. Again, the word of Yahuwah came to me, saying, son of man, prophesy and say, thus says Yahuwah, say, a sword is sharpened and also polished, sharpened to make a dreadful slaughter, polished to flash like lightning. Should we then make mirth? It despises the scepter of my son, as it does all wood, and he has given it to be polished that it might be handled. This sword is sharpened, and it's polished to be given into the hand of the slayer. Cry and wail, son of man, for it will be against my people, against all the princes of Israel. Terror, including the sword, will be against my people. Therefore, strike thigh, because testing. And what if the sword despises even the scepter? The scepter shall be no more, says Yahuwah Eloheka. So let's pause there. Go ahead, Ken. We'll do you this time first again.
Okay. Well, verse 7, Ezekiel is given the response to their question of what this sighing means, just to know what is to come and know that it is true, considering it is word from Yah. So consider the conditions here. Every heart shall melt. All hands shall be feeble. Every spirit shall faint, and all knees shall be weak as water. So those, looking at those four, I find it interesting. Note both that they are within and external in the flesh. Okay? You have the heart and the spirit within. And you have hands and knees that are external. So whether you're looking within or on the external, there will be no strength remaining of anyone whatsoever, is what this is really saying. It just draws out every strength that anybody has. And they will, I mean, this is almost like they just fall. Just plop right on down, which I just watched this video that was well done by Stu Peters called Died Suddenly. And this is what's going on today. People are literally just falling over dead instantly. You know, that's going on today.
I like Stu Peters.
Yeah, he's really good. I listen to him daily. I mean, literally people who have had the vaccine, many of them are just falling over dead. You see it happening to athletes. They'll be running across the field and all of a sudden they just drop dead, you know, happening to people, you know, even people who are up in front of a mic, you know, talking, all of a sudden they just stop talking and plop right over dead. This kind of thing has never happened before.
Pushing the back.
I'm sorry.
They have trouble hiding it when the ones that are saying, oh, take I say they have more trouble hiding it when it's the people who say, take the vax, you got to take this or else, that then croak right on camera.
Yep.
Exactly. Yes.
It's an element, if you will, of, oops. Ah, shucky Derns.
Yeah, exactly. Ironic.
So, yeah, it kind of reminds me of that anyway. There's no strength remaining in these people once they see what is to come, and they believe Yah, because they know what he can do, because there is history that he has provided to all of mankind now for, 1,000 or 2,000 years at least. Now, verses 8 through 11, note how Yah is making the sword the focal point, you know, it being shiny and sharp. So here, you know, you're seeing it with the eyes. So every eye will see it and will now expect such a great slaughter, being told just how shiny and sharp this sword truly is. Does this not help us fully understand the detail that he's provided in verse 7 of how, you know, fully weakened they would be? I mean, this is yet another way, okay? of them feeling this weak. And note verse 10, which I believe is being clear and letting it be known that the day's, that day's authority, which is the rod, would be taken out as well. I mean, if it fits well when you think of trees as men. So sharp metal, such as swords, quickly cuts through and breaks wood. So maybe it's speaking, for example, of King Zedekiah in that particular day as being the rod of his people. But I don't think that it matters which individual was in power. Any and all power was being cut down with the sword here. Okay? It didn't matter who the individual was. Yah was taking it all down. He was clearing out the forest, so to speak, cutting down every tree, with this, shiny and sharp sword. And that's what I have up through verse 11. So I'll let MP catch up a little bit.
All right. Let me see what I can do. Azamra starts on verse 5, and they say this: the prophet himself proclaimed that the people would mock him as a false prophet who simply made up his own clever riddles and parables, on verse 5, according to Radak. Accordingly, God immediately sent him another, much more specific prophecy, retroactively explaining the meaning of the previous allegory by depicting the coming horror of the sword that was to be unleashed against the people of Jerusalem in verses 6 through 10. The forest of the field, in the allegory verse 2, symbolized the holy temple in verse 7, which would be plowed like a field, according to Rashi on verse 2. The consumption of fire, or rather by fire, of every green tree and every dry tree in verse 3 meant that the sword would consume the righteous and the wicked indiscriminately, that in verse 8. Moreover, my sword shall go out of its sheath against all flesh, from the south to the north, in verse 9, because I know that the nations will rejoice over your calamity. I shall vent my fury against them and incite Nebuchadnezzar against them all. That according to Rashi. Okay? Now, my commentary, verses 5 through 7, sure sounds like what will occur in Revelation 19, doesn't it? Yah Yeshua will draw his sword and not sheathe it again until there is no further need of it, which I think will be what we see in Revelation chapter 20, a perfectly governed world by the King Mashiach, against which there will be one more rebellion from those whose evil inclination will not be subjugated to Mashiach. I think that the Messianic kingdom will start out on good footing, with no rebellious people entering, but men will still have a fallen nature at birth, and after 1,000 years of keeping up illusions, those who are born with the initial inhabitants of the Messianic kingdom will begin to rebel and get together for bitch sessions with the invisible chains imposed by that tyrant on the throne in Jerusalem. And then, in verse 6, we see Mashiach's response to the rebellion against him, as portrayed in Revelation 19. Yahushua will sigh at what he will have to do with these who will not live as he wants, even though that is the reason that conditions are living, or for living rather, are so favorable. They have been obeying the righteous requirements of their king, and they are living sumptuously because of his blessing on them as a result. They think it's all them, and that the do-nothing king has nothing whatsoever to do with their ease and prosperity. Is that not exactly what happened with David's kingdom? Have you noticed that our history keeps repeating itself? It does, constantly. In verse 7, when the people notice the prophet's distress, the sighing, and ask him about it, Yah has given him the perfect reply. Because of the outcome that will come due to your rebellion against Yah's word, every heart of every man who has brought this question to me will melt. Melt is from the Hebrew 45:49, masas, which means to melt or dissolve. So men's hearts will dissolve away, not an ounce of strength left. The heart is a muscle. When it melts, the body will necessarily die. The likeness of what will happen in men's hearts, as described in Revelation 19, is, once again, disheartening for this generation, which I believe will see Revelation 19 come to pass. I mean our generation, the one that we're living in right now. I think we're going to see Revelation 19 come to pass. Anyway, that's what I got through verse 7.
Okay.
And are we ready to read on that?
Yeah, please do.
Yeah, at least
I think 11. I already commented to verse 11.
Okay, so he's talking about the sword, and it's grasped for slaughter, it's made bright. Swords at the ready, we continue. Swords thrust right, set your blade, thrust left, wherever your edge is ordered. I will also beat my fist together, and I will cause my fury to rest. I, Yahuwah, have spoken. Shall we pause there? We're going to change subject. Well, not really, but at least a little bit after this.
Which verse was that up to?
Verse 13, I think.
Through 17.
17? Okay.
17. Oh, 17. Okay, now I finished up through verse 11. Where did you stop at, MP?
I stopped at verse 7.
Oh, well, I'll let
you
catch
up. I can catch up to you. What do you think of that?
Sure. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, so verses 8 through 11. The actual prophecy begins in verse 9, where Yah orders Yehezkel to speak again, saying, Ben-Adam, Nava, prophesy. Just an aside, right quick. Who is it that referred to himself as Son of Man? Yeshua and Yehezkel. But more Yehezkel, believe it or not. Yah called Yehezkel sure. Ben-Adam. More often than Yeshua referred to himself as Ben-Adam. Yeshua was called Ben-Adam twice. David used the appellation four times in the Psalms. Yehezkel used the term 93 times just in his book. Do you think that Yah inspired Zeke to write that name down, referring to himself 93 times for a reason? I think that Zeke was the nearest thing to as submitted to Yah as Yeshua himself was. And Yeshua was Yah in human flesh. So anyway, back to the commentary. The sword, a sword, is sharpened and drawn. The word KJV translates furbished is H4803, marat, okay? Literally to oppose unevenness or to remove by force. And that was Yah's plan for the remnant in Yehuda right then, removal by force. In verse 10, the same Hebrew words, nasa and Narat are used again, it seems, to give warning to the inhabitants of the city that it is about to be overrun. The word translated glitter in verse 10 are, the words rather translated glitter in verse 10 are Ki Barak, Haya Barak, I should say. Perhaps living lightning, Haya Barak, could be. So in verses 9 and 10, the inhabitants of Yerushalayim have a force like living, and perhaps breathing or thinking. They have a force like living lightning coming down on them. If they hadn't been or had the bejeebers scared out of them yet, they'd better get a clue, and that right quick. The last phrase in verse 10 means that this sword spurns the rod of my son. Spurns, S-P-U-R-N-S. It thinks nothing of it, okay, as it does every tree. Now, the sword spoken of here spurns, holds in contempt the rod of my son. Now, that rod could be talking about, one, a weapon that wouldn't stand up to a well-cared-for and maintained sword, or two, a scion, like a firstborn, or three, a unique part of the male anatomy, the cutting off of which would make procreation very difficult. Did I circumlocute well enough there for the air? We'll find out. Anyway, the Lemmer has this on verses 11 to 12. In verses 11 to 12, the prophet is instructed to sigh and groan bitterly in front of his fellow exiles in Babylon in order to dramatize the horror that was done to soon to afflict Jerusalem. The reason why he had to do this was because the people simply did not believe that Jerusalem could possibly fall. Even when Nebuchadnezzar was marching against her with his armies, Rashi on verse 28 states that the people did not believe he could succeed. In verse 11, we've seen the English word furbished four times now in three verses, so it must be important to the narrative. It is the Hebrew 4803 Marat, which according to the EDBH, the Etymological Dictionary of Biblical Hebrew, means to oppose unevenness, to remove by force. I get the impression that it has a keen edge and might cut through a mature oak with a single move of the wrist. Well, that was an exaggeration used to make the point that Yah is very serious about this prophecy, and it will be fulfilled. The slayer whom Yah refers to here will have a sweet tool, it requiring little effort to complete his task. That sword that I just talked to you about will be so sharp you can cut through an oak with it. Anyway, that's what I got through verse 11.
Okay. Go ahead.
Alrighty.
Yep, Ken.
Well, we're just about out of time here, aren't we? I'm not sure I can get
just
too
about,
much out.
Yeah, we've got about 30 seconds.
We got all
30 seconds.
Well, so let's just wrap it up. We're talking about the
sword. Go ahead, MC.
We're going to continue with the sword next week. We'll finish chapter 21. And we're going to see that there is there's a fulfillment of prophecy, not just that Ezekiel's talking about, but that all the way back to Moshe it goes, where he says, look, if you won't obey me, you're not going to stay in the land, and all of these things I'm going to tell you are going to happen. In fact, we're
still...
Thanks, God.
It's ending right now.